session that we had before Rosh Hashanah, I feel like I should be up on how your Rosh Hashanah was, and how Yom Kippur was, and how your Sukkot was, and how you've been in general. But maybe we'll wait till after the class at 11 o'clock. I'll stay on for a few minutes afterwards, certainly for questions. But it's 10 a.m., and so it's time for us to get started. I put the link in the chat for the source sheet. I'm going to post it one more time for those who have just joined. And away we go. This topic and this session is a by popular demand session. By the way, just to ask, are you getting background noise, or are you able to hear me all right?
We can hear you, but there's background noise.
Yeah, I'm next door to a classroom. I'm in this new space that I'm using for Zooms. I'm right next door to a classroom, and they're having somebody speaking by Zoom there, and I'm getting it right through the wall. So bonus points if you can recognize who it is. It is the rabbi of a Toronto shul. So if you recognize who it is, bonus points for you. You can put it in the chat. Some of you definitely know. Ooh, you got it, Sarah. You got it in one. Excellent. Yes. So he's going to be done in a couple of minutes there, but that's who it is. In any case. This class, the theme for the series is by popular demand. In June, we had a series on the giants of Sephardic Jewry, and we talked about Shmuel HaNagid, and we talked about Ramban, Nachmanides, we talked about Don Isaac Abarbanel, we talked about Dona Gracia, and there was a lot of interest in learning more about Sephardic Jewry, and so for this series, we are doing, as I called it, los pensadores, the philosophers of, thank you, the Jewish philosophers of medieval Spain. Thank you everybody who registered and who paid. If you're having any trouble with that, let me know. As usual, I plan on recording the audio from the sessions and posting it online on yutorah.org along with the source sheets. So if you ever have to miss a session, I do expect to send out the link to the email list. Make sure you're on the email list for this class. I did send out the source sheet again this morning to those who had registered as of late last night. If you registered this morning, then hopefully I'll add you later today. The goals for this series, basically I want to look at three philosophers who were active in Christian Spain in the 13th to 15th centuries. I see the message someone sent me about changing the audio settings to remove the background noise, and it's a fine idea, but doing it while I'm doing this is probably a recipe for disaster for me. So I think I'm just going to have to struggle through, but knowing the trouble my computer has had this morning, I think it would be risky. So we're going to be looking at Christian Spain specifically. Oh, you know what? I managed to get... Let me see if I can fix it. Suppress background noise. It's already on auto for suppressing background noise. I'm going to try this and see what happens. See if it gets any better. Okay, does that change anything for you in terms of background noise? It's now on high suppression.
Okay.
Sorry?
It's okay.
It's okay. Well, I hope it's okay because it's what I got.
It's fine. I mean, I think this is... The background management
rule,
I think.
Okay.
Or maybe I'm just getting older, I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. Either way, this will be, it's what we have right now. So the three philosophers will be Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, and we'll be talking about him today. Then Rabbeinu Nisim, who we'll talk about, I hope, next week. And then Rabbi Yosef Albo. And as I think of them, the way that I've outlined them for myself, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, who we'll talk about today, I think of as holding the line. And you'll see what we mean by that. Rabbeinu Nisim, I think of as a political philosopher. And then Rabbi Yosef Albo, I think of as moving the line. The line that Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet held, Rabbi Yosef Albo moved. And you'll see as we go through it. But to talk about Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet as somebody is holding the line, I think a fine example of that is a document that I am that I've included part of on the source sheet in source number one. This is from the year 1305, and it was a ban on the study of secular philosophy. And it was signed by a group of rabbis in the year 1305, including Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, whose signature was very sought after for this document. We're going to have to talk about the background for the document, what led to this point, but take a look at it in source number one on the sheet. From this day on, and for the next 50 years, no member of our community shall study the, quote, Greek works on science and metaphysics, either in the original, i.e. Arabic, or in translation, before you will be the age of 25. Nor may any member of our community teach the aforesaid disciplines to anyone under the age of 25, lest these studies draw the student away from the Torah of Israel, which is superior to this other learning. We have exempted from our decree the study of medicine, although it is a natural science, for the Torah has given the physician permission to practice the art of healing. This is Yitzhak Baer's translation in A History of the Jews and Christian Spain. I highly recommend the book. There's a ton of really useful information in there. Added pieces of information. First of all, we have a letter from Rashba, from Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, in which his version of the ban also says you're allowed to study astronomy, you're also allowed to study the philosophy of Maimonides. We'll have to talk about that. Other interesting note on this, if you take a look at source number two, is that saying that people can't study it until the age of 25 was a way to defang the ban. What do I mean? Take a look at number two from Dr. Baer. The reformers appear to us, the reformers are the people who are banning philosophy, as you'll see. So the reformers appear to us to have acted with circumspection and with relative tolerance in setting the age of 25 as the proper time to begin the study of metaphysics. They actually conformed to the academic practice then in effect among the Jews as well as among the Christians. Students did not, for the most part, enter upon the study of philosophy until the age of 25 or 30. So in other words, you're saying you're not allowed to study philosophy until you are of age when they normally start studying philosophy in university. Tell me something. What do you take from this? What is the idea? I mean, we have a lot of background we need to give that'll give us a better perspective on what's going on. But your reaction here, what do you think would have sparked this kind of thing? Yes, Rose.
So I think that what happens, the reporting was saying, you have to be entrenching your identity. And therefore, they were fearful that they would not be. But if you're up to the age of 25, in other words, you're so entrenched in who you are, your identity, that they were afraid that by changing onto philosophy, they'd actually move completely away from the religion.
Right. So we're going to talk about that. It's a good point. Just a request. I know people are unmuting in order to be able to speak, which is fine. But I hear someone has little kids in the background, which doesn't bother me much, but I think the combination of that and the noise on my end is going to make it distracting for some people. So if you're not actually speaking, I would say to mute, please. So definitely there's an issue of protecting the religion, that's for sure. Janine?
Wasn't there a man, didn't the Rambam say you had to be born, I don't remember, I thought it was 4 years old, that you had to be born this kind of open it up a little bit and kind of
right.
Have a link to that, but we'll allow it for 25.
Right. So what I think you may be thinking of was that Maimonides, Rambam, says you're not supposed to study, in general, the natural sciences and so on until you have first filled yourself with meat and wine, meaning Torah study. You have to have Torah knowledge first before going into it. He does not impose an age. But what this ban was, we'll see, was a response to certain challenges within the Jewish community. It's an attempt to make a statement, but as Baer notes, it's a statement that doesn't really have teeth because it's a because of the permission to do it at the age of 25. So we're going to have to talk about what it was that created this. That's number one. Number two, if you take a look at source number three, tell me something. This is a real challenge now. For anyone who was in the session that we had back in June, the name Ibn Khazm, does it ring a bell? Ibn Khazm. We discussed him in our first session in that course. I put the name in the chat as well. Anybody remember who he was?
Did he talk against the Jewish religion, against the Torah, saying that it was all...
Yes. You got it. Ibn Khazm was a Muslim who wrote against the Torah, said the Torah was basically a forgery. But the person he dealt with, his interlocutor among the Jews, was Shmuel HaNagid, who you may recall lived in the 11th century. And yet, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, who lives, as we'll see, in the 13th into the 14th centuries, writes a response to him. Take a look at source number three, the beginning of that response. And I gave you a link where you could actually read the original Hebrew online. The title of it, as I put there, is translated into English as a statement on an Ishmaelite who wrote of religions. And he was a fool who spoke even against our perfect religion. That's the title of the piece. The title, I feel like, needs its own chapter. But he begins by saying, I saw a fool who was wise in his own eyes. A fool, an Ishmaelite whose eyes misled him and whose blindness confused him, to speak even upon our sacred book, the book of the Torah of our master Moses, peace be upon him. And this sad, degraded person collected scraps to respond to the Torah's words, which he did not grasp. That's the opening of his work against Ibn Khazm. Now we're going to talk about Ibn Khazm, and we're going to talk about what he said about Ibn Khazm's work. But what I find particularly fascinating here is the time difference. You're publishing this 200 years after Ibn Khazm died. Why are you bothering? Ibn Khazm's gone. Like, and with such vitriol, right? You look at this. He calls him a fool, he's blind, he's degraded, he's like, you know, what exactly is the force behind what he's doing here? So that's our second point. I'll ask you, what do you think? What do you think would motivate a Jewish leader, scholar, thinker in the 13th century to write really, you know, powerfully against a Muslim thinker from 200 years before? Sorry?
Maybe he had followers that Ibn Khazm.
Maybe there were followers a couple of hundred years later. Maybe. Could be. Possible.
Is Marilee on the telephone?
I hear somebody on the telephone. Yes, is that Marilee?
Yes.
Is it? Yeah.
Yes, it is. My idea would be it's a way to get past the censors, and you're actually criticizing Christians, but if you put it under the label of attacking someone else, you can say whatever you wish.
Very good. So it's entirely possible that this is actually meant to target the church, but he's living in Christian Spain. And when you're living in medieval Christian Spain, the last thing you want to do, because it is the last thing you will do, is to write a document like this against Christianity. So it could be that that's what's driving it. We'll have to see more, though. So there's a lot that we need to discuss. And really, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, who is our topic for today, is really so large a figure that the hour that we're doing, and it's going to bleed into next week, let's not kid ourselves, is going to be tip of the iceberg. He's such a remarkable figure with such an imprint. But we'll do what we can. So we have to start by talking about 13th century Christian Spain. Remember that the Muslims control, as of the 8th century, the Muslims control Andalusia. They have a lot of land basically covering most of Spain. And then the church, over time, conquers land back, working from northern Spain and then working their way south in waves. They take territory. This is called the Reconquista, the process of conquering back the land for Christianity. At this stage, in the 13th century, the northern half of the country is Christian. It's not really a country. I keep using the word country, but it's not. They're really separate provinces at this point. A lot of what Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet does is actually specifically in the province of Aragon, which is really far north in Spain. That's where Barcelona is. That's what we're talking about. I should note, by the way, because I've already mentioned the acronym, and I'm going to use it a lot probably, just because it's the way it works. The acronym that I'm going to be using, I just put it in the chat, is RASHBA. RASHBA, and I'll put the Hebrew version of it in the chat as well, stands for Rabbi Shlomo Ben Avraham, and that's how Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet is often known. So, just to be aware, if I ever say RASHBA, I mean the same person. So, if you remember from the class that we had on Nachmanides, on Ramban, in the year 1250, Pope Innocent IV issues a decree against the Jews because the Jews are not wearing the Jewish badge, the special clothing that's supposed to mark them as different. And so he writes a decree against Jews living in the same house as Christians, eating with Christians, generally associating with Christians. Nonetheless, the Jews in northern Spain had freedom to engage in trades, to own land, and to live as Jews. You just had to be apart from the Christians. At the same time, that's in terms of official policy, but there were great threats to the Jewish community and to the religiosity of the community. First of all, there were external threats. Jews faced threats of violence from multiple directions. There were church decrees, like the decree of Pope Innocent IV that we just mentioned. There were Catholic preachers who rallied mobs against the Jews. There were forced disputations. When we talked about Nachmanides, we talked about his dispute with Pablo Cristiani in 1263, and we'll see that Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet got involved in those disputes as well. There were peasants who were jealous of Jews who were doing well. And then there were the governments, which wanted their funds. And, you know, the king of your province was your friend until he was not your friend. That's basically the way it worked. And I'll give you an example from King Alfonso X. He was the king of three provinces, Leon, Castile, and Galicia. So take a look, please, at source number 4, please, from Baer's History of the Jews. And people have joined, so I will once again put the link in the chat for the source sheet. Okay. Source number 4. The sinister side of Alfonso's character was revealed toward the end of his reign, after his imperial ambitions involved his kingdom in the remote politics of the Holy Roman Empire, and was confronted with an uprising of the nobility and the rebellion of his son, Sancho. The treatment of the Jews... Every time I hear Sancho, I think of Don Quixote. Anyway. The treatment of the Jews in the other European countries did not go unnoticed in Spain. Meaning, what's coming up next. Twice during this period, the Jews were expelled from France. Right? Those countries we didn't get expelled from once, we got expelled from twice. In England, class interests and religio-ascetic tendencies were preparing the ground for their ultimate expulsion. Conditions in Spain had not yet reached this stage, yet a personal caprice of Alfonso X brought down upon the heads of the Castilian Jews the first catastrophic blow whose consequences are known to us in detail. And here's the story. The year 1278, There is a fellow who I don't think was Jewish, but I'm not 100% sure. Danshai de la Maleha, if I'm pronouncing that right. As the head tax farmer of Leon and Castile, right? Everyone, do people know what a tax farmer is? The tax farmer buys the rights to collect the taxes from the community, keeping a certain amount for himself, and he has to pay the government as well. So he was ordered to forward a sum of money to the army and navy besieging Algeciras. But the infant Sancho, son of the king, got hold of the money and diverted it to his own ends. And the forces before Algeciras found themselves in dire straits. They're out of money. The king, in a vindictive mood, imprisoned all the Jewish tax farmers in 1279. One of them saved his life through conversion. Another, apparently an intimate of Sancho, was dragged to death through the streets of Sevilla, past the monastery where the infant had taken up residence. Danshai was hanged. Then, one Sabbath day in January 1281, the king had all the Jews arrested in their synagogues and did not release them until they agreed to pay him a little over 4 million gold maravedis, and I don't know what that is, except that it's a sum twice the annual tribute of the Castilian aljamas. Remember that the aljama was a district. So if you take all the districts in the province of Castilla, double what they were supposed to pay, that's what was demanded of the Jews. Alfonso X thus followed the example set by Philip II of France a century earlier. Many of the leading Jews were kept in prison for several months, where they were subjected to torture and attempts to convert them. We don't know what took place elsewhere, but the Jewish community of Toledo was demolished, quote, like Sodom and Gomorrah. That's their description of what they endured. So what you find is a threat from the governments, even though legally Jews were allowed to be there. There was also government interference in the affairs of the Jewish community, sometimes at the government's instigation and sometimes because people within the Jewish community invited them to become involved, something that we're going to have to discuss. Sometimes we brought it on ourselves because that's something that Jews do professionally. So the picture that I'm trying to show you is of a Jewish community that letter of the law is tolerated, is able to be there, is able to run businesses, is able to own land, but in practice is facing multiple threats from outside. Clear? We got it? At the same time, you have internal threats. There were internal threats, first of all, from ideas that departed from traditional Judaism, and particularly a kind of rationalism that goes back to Greek thought and the ideas of Aristotle, that promoted seeing the Torah and even its laws as an allegory, not something to be taken literally. And if you take a look at source number 5, I bring you from Baer one more time here. The cities of Languedoc, Montpellier, Narbonne, Perpignan, were the home of a number of versatile Jewish intellectuals, among them the well-known translators of Arabic works into Hebrew. This is in France, obviously. Some religious zealots, also resident in these communities, began to suspect that the vines of philosophic rationalism cultivated by these intellectual circles had produced some very dangerous fruit. The rationalists, in their writings and oral preachings, at times adopted a radical approach to the sacred writings, to Tanakh. They interpreted biblical miracles allegorically and assigned a symbolic function to the commandments of the Torah. So the Torah doesn't really mean don't eat pork. The Torah really means some other message that's embodied in that. Don't dirty yourself the way that a pig will be in the mud or something. It was also reported that they denied personal immortality, the idea that the soul lives on. They stripped the messianic ideal of its traditionally assigned concrete forms. They said Mashiach isn't really a human being who's going to be a Messiah. It's a concept. To the fundamentalists, such ideas were naturally naked heresy and outright blasphemy. So you have threats from the outside to the Jewish community, physical threats to their survival. You have people internally who are straying from traditional Jewish belief. And then you also have a breakdown of what was probably thought of as traditional Jewish social morality. And I give you an example in source number 6. This is a question that was put to Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, Rashba, and I just brought you the question that was put to him because it illustrates the kinds of things that he dealt with. Reuven had a Jewish maidservant in his house. He acted corruptly with her, and you understand what that means. After some time, she became pregnant while with him. He didn't know whether it was from him or from another. Am I the father? Don't know. He expelled her from his home. After some time, he brought her back, and she was pregnant from that time. He placed her in his relative's home at the time of the birth, and the conversation ends up being about whether the child is legitimate, what's the paternity assumed to be of the child, and so on. These are the types of questions that he's facing. It's not, Rabbi, is this kind of creature kosher? Or, Rabbi, my friend and I have some kind of litigation between us, and can you resolve it? It's men who are sleeping with the servant woman in the house and producing children, and they don't even know if it's from them. So this was something, by the way, that bothered the church as well. The church dealt with claims of Christian women becoming involved with Jewish men, and they were really not happy about that. And then let's go one more source. Source number 7. The prophet of Avilia. Not much is known about this person to the extent that the best article I found online that summed things up neatly was from encyclopedia.com. Normally I wouldn't really go with that as a source, but it actually did a nice job of summing it up, so that's what I used here. The prophet of Avilia is the name given to a seer, visionary, who declared himself at Avilia, Spain in 1295. The prophet, an illiterate man, purportedly experienced visions through the medium of an angel who dictated to him a book of wondrous wisdom on which the seer immediately compiled a detailed commentary. The work has not been preserved, but evidently resembled the Christian mystical prophecies of this type common in the 13th and 14th centuries, except that he's Jewish. The prophet of Avilia is also mentioned by the apostate Avner of Burgos, who records that a prophet announced that the ram's horn of the Messiah would be blown on the last day of the month of Tammuz. The Jews of the district prepared themselves by prayer and fasting, and on the appointed day gathered in the synagogue robed in white, whereupon crosses suddenly appeared on their garments. The community was panic-stricken. Some were induced to adopt Christianity. So, what you're getting here is, I hope, a complete picture of a community that very much feels itself under siege. Physical threats from without, threats from the church without, threats from within in terms of their philosophy, this false Messiah, their morality. You follow? So what we've done in the last, almost half hour is to get a sense of what the community was like. Let's shift gears now to talk about Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet. By the way, again, Shlomo is Solomon. When I say Rabbi Shlomo, Rabbi Solomon, same person, also known as Rashba. Interestingly, in Hebrew, they always say Ben or Ibn Aderet. However, the historians tend to say that it's actually Adret. I don't know why. It's not a Muslim name, Adret, I don't know, but Adret is the technically correct pronunciation, they said. He's born in the year 1235, approximately. It's not entirely clear, but somewhere around 1235. He dies in the year 1310. You find that often with great scholars in the Jewish tradition, that the year they're born we don't know so well, but the year they die we know because of what they accomplished in their lifetime, which led to people watching and people recording about them. He lived in Barcelona. Barcelona, of course, was where Nachmanides was as well. His main mentors were Nachmanides, who we studied last June, as well as Nachmanides' cousin, Rabbeinu Yona is his name. He was from the town of Gerona, which is a little bit east of Aragon. Both Nachmanides and Rabbeinu Yona were great scholars of Talmud, They were both conservative in their approach to Jewish philosophy. They were, Nachmanides in particular, actually, was a major community leader as well as a mystic. Rabbeinu Yonah placed a very heavy emphasis on improving one's religious piety and personal character. So these are the mentors of Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet. They are community figures, they're scholars, there's mysticism there, there's pietism there, improving one's religiosity. And he, Rabbi ibn Aderet, was a star from a very young age. He's not one of these Rabbi Akiva types who comes into it late. He was already writing commentary on the Talmud in his early 20s. We have dates for his responsa, a lot of them, such that we know he was already being approached by communities for answers to questions when he was 29. Possibly earlier. The earliest dated one that I have been able to find reference to is the year 1264, when he's about 29 years old. He was not only trained in Judaism, though, he knew Latin, and he was versed in secular law. And we see that it comes through in his writings. He made his money as a money lender, specifically for the government. We have on record that he was a creditor to the government in a transaction in the year 1283, a particular one. But in general, he made money by lending money, and particularly to the government. He was heavily involved in governing and leading the community. Nachmanides left Spain in the year 1267. Remember, Nachmanides had his big disputation in the year 1263. He was persecuted after that. In the year 1267, Nachmanides went to make Aliyah, to go to Israel. So at that point, Rabbi ibn Aderet takes over and becomes the leader of the Jewish community, and he remains that way from 1267 until his death in the year 1310. He was involved not only in guiding the community in Aragon, but beyond. He writes responsa about how to choose elders to govern the community and to be judges. He was involved with the Spanish government. Yitzhak Baer, the writer of that book that I've already referred to a couple of times, the history of, I'm blanking on the exact title, I will look back at my source sheet, History of the Jews in Christian Spain. So he actually lists quite a few royal documents from the government archives that speak about questions that they referred to Rabbi ibn Aderet for adjudication. He had a very expansive view of the authority of government to legislate for the Jewish community. You may be familiar with the following phrase, Dina de Malchuta Dina. I'm writing it into the chat as well, although my computer just stopped typing. There it goes. Dina de Malchuta Dina. It means the law of the nation is the law. The law of the empire, technically, is, or the law of the kingdom, is the law. It's a line that goes back to the Talmud, but it's controversial in its application. Historically, there have been those who took it very, very narrowly and said, in context in the Talmud, it's a law about taxes, saying that if the government issues a tax, you have to pay it. The reason why that needed to be stated in the Talmud is because you had, at that point, self-appointed tax collectors. And you had people who were tax farmers who bought the rights to collect taxes from the government, but then they would collect whatever they wanted to collect. They would basically become bandits. So the principle in the Talmud is the government has the authority to issue taxes, to claim, you know, to demand taxes be paid. Some have interpreted just about taxes. Some have taken it very broadly. In the pandemic, that's been a big discussion, that the government has the ability to legislate in whatever way it sees fit for the good of its citizens. Rabbi ibn Aderet is on the broad view of that. He believes the government can legislate as needed for the benefit of the population. If you take a look at source number 8 as an example of that from a responsum of his, he's talking about a rule the government had made that involved a redesign of the urban layout of a Jewish area. And he says, the king's order to make an entrance and doors in the middle of the neighborhood to protect the nation is within his authority. the law of Jewish kings is equal to that of the nations in this regard. Just like a Jewish king can do it, so too a secular king can do it. Also, even Jewish kings are permitted to do such things as part of protecting their nation. This is legitimate, is his statement. The government has the ability to make that kind of statement. Where he did draw the line was where that becomes at the expense of Jewish law. Where you end up in a situation in which people say, well then we don't need our laws to govern interactions when the government's laws already take care of it. Example, inheritance. The Torah sets out a system of inheritance. The government has its own rules for how inheritance should work. So people said, well, let's just follow the government's rules. So that's something the Rabbi Ibn Aderet was not comfortable with at all. Take a look at source number 9 from another responsum of his where he speaks about this issue. He says, to deduce from this, from Dina de Machuta Dina, from the principle of obeying government legislation, to deduce from that, to follow the ways of the nations and their laws, God forbid that this holy nation, that will be us, should act thus. All the more so if they will now increase their sin, uprooting the portion of a father upon his children, the inheritance, depending upon this fragile reed to say, well, I'm just going to rely on what the government does. One who does this tears down the walls of the Torah and uproots root and branch, and the Torah will demand recompense from his hand. One who increases his wealth thus will stumble in his own deeds. And I say that any who rely on saying this is permitted because we must obey the law of the land is mistaken and a thief. He uproots all the laws of the complete Torah. Why would we need the sacred texts which Rebbe, Ravina, Rav Ashi, all the sages of the Talmud composed for us? Let them teach their children the laws of the nations and build for them patchwork altars in the madrasas of the nations. That's actually based on a verse in Ezekiel and Yechezkel. God forbid that there not be such in Israel, lest the Torah wear sackcloth. He says, God forbid, there's no way. He says, yes, you have to follow the government's rules for the benefit of the nation, but not where that would set you against the laws of the Torah. You follow? The government decides everyone has to eat a cheeseburger for lunch. On Wednesdays, you don't eat a cheeseburger. That's the distinction. His style in his responsa, very direct, very blunt. He believed in an activist judiciary. He believed that you need to add laws in order to safeguard the community. Take a look at source number 10. Those of you who were with me when we had the series FFMF on policing, kosher cops as we called it at the time, this source came up then as well. He says, if you were to establish everything on the basis of biblical law, all the community's rules are just based on what the biblical law is, and you would not punish anyone other than as the Torah does for injuries and the like, the world would be ruined. He says, you can't go based on just what the Torah legislates. We would require witnesses and warnings. It's very hard, biblically, to be able to punish somebody for wrongdoing. He says, you need to create new rules. So he's very strong, and he's very active, and he says, this is the way it's going to be. And yet, we're going to see that he tries to avoid getting involved in community strife. We'll see that in the philosophy controversy. He was not knee-jerk on issues. One of the major issues of his day was called Mesira. Can someone explain what Mesira is? Or what a Moser is?
Giving over
information about a person to the government. Right. Giving over information about a person to the government. Exactly correct. As was noted in the chat, Diane wrote in, handing over a Jew. It means where you take somebody and make him vulnerable to the government. This was a major issue in those days because there were Jews who would be in a fight with somebody else who was Jewish. And when they weren't winning, they would first threaten and then potentially even act on it, turn the person over to the government, say, you know, come up with some reason why the government should take his property. And Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet was very careful about getting involved in stuff like that. He was not so comfortable labeling somebody a Moser for turning over a Jew. He felt you have to be very cautious with that label. He tried to get peace in managing disputes. I gave you an example in source number 11, but I'm going to say it outside of the text because I had to include some Hebrew. It wouldn't work without it. But basically, there was a dispute in a community because the community had hired somebody to be a shaliach tzibur, to be the cantor, to lead services. However, there was another group within the community that had hired somebody else to lead services. I'll never forget my first prabha, my first community where I went to interview to be a synagogue rabbi when I was fresh out of rabbinical school. It was a certain community, which obviously shall remain nameless, but I had an interview Shabbos set up. I was going to go there and speak and meet people and so on. And then the Wednesday before, I get a call from someone telling me that she's representing Search Committee 2, a breakaway search committee. So, message to young rabbis everywhere. That's when you say, thanks but no thanks. When you get your call from Search Committee 2, it's time to cut bait. I did not. I went for Shabbos. It was interesting. Very nice people. I really liked the community, but did not end up there. But that's what happens in this story. This responsum is written because the community had two different groups hire a shaliach tzibur, hire a leader, hire a cantor. So the question now is, one of those groups wasn't really licensed by the community. So should they simply say, whoever was hired by the outlaws is not hired, you are unhired? So the answer is no. Rabbi Ibn Aderet says, yeah, this happens from time to time. It happened to us in Barcelona once. I think you should eliminate strife, restore love and brotherhood and peace. And what you should do is hire them both, hopefully at a reduced salary, but hire them both and let them take turns. One Shabbos this one Shabbos that one. The one who was hired first gets to lead first, then the other one the next Shabbos. And that's the way it'll work. And just that way you retain both of them, and that way you don't alienate people. Now, I imagine that there will be certain people who are only going to show up in shul every other Shabbos, because they want to hear their guy. Nonetheless, my point in bringing this is not to say, look, wisdom of Solomon, although it is, his name was Solomon. But my point in this is to say, he didn't take letter of the law. He's looking for a way to compromise, even though he was so blunt and so direct, and we're going to really see that. Nonetheless, he's looking for peace. His legacy is tremendous. His students continue the line of Spanish Talmud study and philosophy. For those who are familiar with Rabbi Yom Tov Elashvili, also known as the Ritva, Elashvili, Rabbeinu Bechaye, those are students of his. He published more than 3,000 responsa, by far more than anybody else in that era. And they were already collected in published editions in his own day. So much so that there are different editions of his responsa that were identified accidentally as somebody else's, and others who were identified as his. There's a little confusion. But over 3,000 responsa that went everywhere. It went obviously throughout Sephardi Europe, North Africa, Israel, and Ashkenazi lands. The Ashkenazim also sought him out for counsel. He was a giant. So that's background on who he was. Good? Are we clear? Okay. I know I'm monologuing a lot. I hope that's okay. But really, interrupt if there's a question or something. Okay, then let's go further. So, let's talk now about his issues with philosophy. We have to begin by talking about his external issues. And that brings us back to Ibn Chazm. So when we learned about Shmuel HaNagid last June, we learned that Ibn Chazm wrote against Judaism in the time of Shmuel HaNagid, the 11th century. He claimed that the Torah is not authentic. He said that the Torah that we teach is not the original. He said it anthropomorphizes God. It describes God having traits of human beings, even extending his arm and getting angry and things like that. And Islam rejects all of that. It also has stories that describe our leaders behaving in apparently immoral ways, which he said was done in order to mock them. Take a look at source number 12, please. Martin Jacobs, the historian, wrote a paper called Interreligious Polemics in Medieval Spain. In this paper of his, he gives you translations of Ibn Khazm's work. And that's what I'm bringing you here for number 12. By God, Ibn Khazm writes, I have never seen a people which, while acknowledging the idea of prophethood, ascribes to the prophets what those infidels, the Jews, ascribe to them. Once they attribute to Abraham, peace be with him, that he was married to his sister, who bore him Isaac, peace be with him. Then they attribute to Jacob that he married one woman, but that another woman who was not his wife was brought to him secretly, right, Rachel and Leah, and that she, Leah, bore him children from whom Moses, Aaron, David, Solomon, and other prophets, peace be with them, are descended. He says, look at this immoral behavior that's ascribed to figures in the Bible. He says, this Bible isn't meant to honor them. This Bible is meant to degrade them and make fun of them. You follow? He also argued, Ibn Khazm argued, that the history found in the Bible is challenging. After all, look at the reproduction rate of the families who are recorded in the Bible. As an example, he goes through the families of the tribe of Levi. He points out, and in source number 13, I brought you from a paper from Camilla Adeng, a Jewish reply to Ibn Khazm, Solomon ibn Adaret's polemic against Islam. Although it's not really a polemic against Islam, it's more a response defending Judaism. He doesn't attack Islam. But in any case, Ibn Khazm says, this is one of the most nonsensical things that can be, that the sons of Kahat were only four, the sons of these four men were only seven in number, and yet by the time the Jews get a few generations later, they have thousands of descendants. Kahat, for reference, if anybody's curious, Levi, the original Levi, son of Jacob, had three sons, Gershon, Kahat, and Merari. Kahat has four sons, Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel. Amram's kids are Moshe, Aharon, and Miriam. So that's just to orient you in terms of the family. So just a few generations later, there are thousands of Levites. How did that happen? How does Kehat have thousands of descendants, aside from his siblings, Gershon and Merari? So he says, it can't be. The whole thing is false, he says. Interestingly, though, Muslims claimed, like Christians, that sections of the Bible predict their savior. Right? Christians make this prediction all the time. Muslims do too. They say that the Torah predicts Islam and predicts Muhammad. So he said, those parts that predict Muhammad, those are authentic. It's the other parts that aren't. Ibn Khazm, though, was not the only one with these questions about the Torah. I mean, at one point in a class, we learned about Rav Sadia Gaon and how he responded to a fellow named Chivi Habalki, who may have been a Karaite in the 9th century, who asked a lot of these questions. And these questions form the basis of a lot of our traditional study of the Torah, meaning traditional commentators ask these questions and deal with them and come up with answers. So the questions aren't really new with Ibn Khazm, but Ibn Khazm is using them to undermine the authenticity of the Torah. So Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet writes a response. Again, 200 years later. The response, the title of which we already saw before, I'll give you the Hebrew version of it, but for those who want to see the English again, because I abbreviated it from here on out on the sheet, but you can go back to source number 3, you see the full English title of it. The Hebrew is, Ma'amar al Yishmael shechiber al hadatot v'hu kisil shediber af al datenu hashalema. Those who know Hebrew can see I translated it fairly literally on the sheet. So, interestingly, Adang notes, and I brought it on the sheet in source number 14, Rashba responds in the same style as Ibn Khazm. What is interesting, she says, is that Ibn Adret adopts a polemical style not unlike Ibn Khazm's own. Ibn Khazm wrote that way. He calls the Muslim scholar a vainglorious man who does not understand what he is talking about, a brainless idiot, and most often hamishuga hazeh, this madman. Now, don't be surprised about the use of the word mishuga. That's a biblical word, which often gets used in statements against Islam, starting already back in the 8th, 9th, 10th century. Maimonides called Muhammad the Mishuga. It's because there is a verse that speaks of people who think of themselves as prophets, and it uses the term the Mishuga. That's where it's coming from. So he calls Ibn Khazm that. In comparison with Ibn Adret's polemical tract against the Ishmaelite, his tract against a likewise unidentified Christian, possibly Raymondus Martini, is completely dispassionate and devoid of the vilifications that characterize his tract against Ibn Khazm. It would seem then that Ibn Adret adopts the style of the tract or set of excerpts he is refuting. Meaning, we're going to see his response to Ibn Khazm. With Ibn Khazm, he writes very sharply. We are also going to see a response of his to a Christian who he's debating with, and he's very polite. Now, you could argue that that's because the Christians are in authority, right? Being as rude to the Christian as he is to Ibn Khazm could result in problems. That could be. That's possible. But it's also because the tenor of their comments is like that. Ibn Khazm is making fun of Judaism. He's going to make fun of Ibn Khazm. The Christian writer is also attacking Judaism, but in a much more well-mannered way. So he responds that way. But what's interesting within that is it suggests that Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet actually saw Ibn Khazm's writing. He's not just responding. Remember, I asked the question in the beginning of the session. I wanted to know why is he responding to someone from 200 years ago? And it was suggested that maybe what he's actually doing is he's responding to those in his day, right, who are followers of those ideas. But now this suggests that he saw Ibn Khazm's writing. He's really responding to an original text or set of excerpts, as Edeng notes. So some of his arguments for the authenticity of Torah, he says, first of all, Torah has perfect grammar. Now, you look at it and say, okay, so what? But in those days, that was a very big deal. The debates between Jews and Muslims, going back to the 10th century, the Kuzari, for example, each one claims that their book is sacred, and as proof of it, they say the language is perfect. Perfect and precise. So that's one of his points. Yes, Susan.
If we're saying that he actually knew Ibn Khazm's writing, why did he actually, was it a segue to get to Christianity, or was it, was Ibn
that's where we're going.
Popular?
That's where I'm going in the next few minutes. So good question, hang in there. He also argued for consistency of transmission. He said, you're claiming that we have changed the Torah? Take a look, he says. Take a look here on the sheet, I say. At source number 15. He says, if one would claim that all of this was added to the text, right? Like the stories about the prophets doing immoral things. He says, you're going to claim it was added, as well as that all that comes in the Torah in this section is from after the destruction of the temple, then anyone with sense, anyone with a brain in his skull, would recognize, would it be possible to collect all of the texts that were in the hands of Israelites, east and west, north and the sea, and pervert them with the same error? And not one of them would escape to be different from the others in some matter or word? In other words, he's saying, you think they changed all the Torah scrolls to reflect this new thing? And who would be the perverter of the religion and enemy of the nation who would collect all the texts such that not one would remain and pervert all of them? Who has the power to do that? Also the books of the prophets and the writings in which many such things appear, right? The rest of Tanakh, not just the Bible. And all of this would be done without any member of the religion realizing it? He says, who are you kidding? The authenticity of the Torah is verified by the fact that it was transmitted so broadly around the world. You can't modify it. Yes, Janine.
Going back to the first argument, I don't understand that. I mean, there are so many, many, many places where the commentators ask why a word which is probably not really the most appropriate one is used, and they explain it. And also, are other texts with the Christian or the Quran not grammatical? And that seems like such a...
So that's the argument, yes.
Funny proof.
Yeah, it does seem a funny proof, and you're right. We have problems with lots of words, but keep in mind, every time we have a problem with why is this word this way, we always provide justification. So he'll argue that if it's ever imprecise, it's to teach a lesson. That's how he'll go with it. But yeah, funny. I mean, to us, it's certainly very funny. This is not what we think of, certainly. As for the stories that have people doing terrible things, so he says they're meant to teach lessons. As an example, he has the story of Lot and his daughters, right? Those who don't remember the story, after the destruction of Sodom, Lot is hiding in a cave with his two daughters. They think that the world's been destroyed and they have to restart it. And so they get him drunk and produce children from him. Now, the truth of the matter is that we don't hold up Lot as a role model anyway. The Torah already looks down on Lot severely. Nonetheless, he said he uses that as an example. It's not the only one. But he says in source number 16, some of the stories mention something because we need to know it in another context. We need to know a lesson from it. To know from it something that mandates distancing from that which should be distanced. Or to do something. It's teaching us to do something. Like the story of Lot with his daughters. To distance drinking a lot of wine for someone who knows that his nature is that he will become confused to the point of intoxication. Right? The point is to teach us a lesson about what drinking can do. That's what it's there for. And he says, and this is something that I've been hearing since grade school, you know the stories of corrupt behavior are authentic because otherwise why in the world would we have left them in? Just the opposite. If you have a book that paints everybody as saints, you have to start questioning the validity of the book. When you have a book that records the stuff ours records, it wouldn't be there if it wasn't true. He says, take a look at source number 17, where he talks about King David being descended from Lot's daughters. He says, you, sir, open your eyes and see. If this was inserted into the text from the mouth of our master Moses, peace be upon him, then it's true. If Moses said it, it's true. And if it was added later, how did our king, David, and all the kings who emerged from his line tolerate this to be written in the text? Saying explicitly that he was born from promiscuity, meaning Lot's daughters, and they didn't erase it, and that he would tolerate that if he recorded in his text that his mother came from Moab, right, Ruth, his great-grandmother was a Moabite originally, with her roots in promiscuity with her family, with her father Lot, because Moab is one of the sons born from Lot and his daughters, he says that it would only be recorded if it was true. So he argues with Ibn Khazm. Last point. Who was he writing for? So I gave you references on the sheet, but I'm just going to say it outside because of time. It's already 10:59. But the answer is, he says, I'm doing it in order to answer the folly of Ibn Khazm. That's what he himself said. But it makes no sense. Rather, either it is suggested, and I brought it for you from Martin Jacobs, either he is refuting Christian ideas of his day, or it's because he believes that the Jews are vulnerable to these ideas. He thinks that what Ibn Khazm raised still bothers Jews of his time. So he's using Ibn Khazm as a piñata to get out messages. Hey, that was nice. I got in the Spanish word. He's using that as a piñata in order to convey messages that he wants to convey to the Jews of his time. Because he believes we are under threat. You follow? So what we've gotten in the last hour, I hope, is number one, that we're going to see a strong response to the study of philosophy. We didn't get there yet. That's going to have to be the beginning of next week. But we saw the threats to the Jewish community from outside forces, from government, from the peasants, from the church, as well as threats internally from immorality, from threats to standard Jewish belief, from false messiahs. And into this comes Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, student of Nachmanides, student of Rabbeinu Yonah, an activist leader in the government, involved with the Spanish government, somebody who believes in telling it like it is, although he does pursue peace in his responsa. And our first stop in seeing his approach is that he debates Jewish philosophy with a Muslim in order to try to defend Judaism to the Jews of his day. What we'll do next time, God willing, before we get to Rabbeinu Nissim, is show how he debated Christians as well. And that was live. That wasn't a 200-year-old document. And then we'll see how he deals with the study of secular philosophy as well as mysticism in the Jews of his day. And that will wrap up Rashba. Then we go on to Rabbeinu Nissim, a political philosopher. Thank you very much. I'm gonna stay on to discuss further for a few minutes because, you know, that's always nice, and because I want to catch up with you. I haven't seen you in a long time, but anybody who has to go, feel free to do so. And I'm going to send out the link for the recording, God willing, later. Thank you very much.